This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. On today's show, we're going to hear a report from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the war for the Arctic. This is an inhospitable region that holds tremendous undiscovered oil and gas reserves and huge amounts of gold, platinum, and other minerals. Russia is tapping into this wealth, and it is enacting plans to dominate the Arctic. We'll also talk about fragrance. We have a fascinating conversation here with Jörg Mardian about the fragrances that companies are putting into their stores, into their products, fragrances that we're putting in our hair, on our skin, in our clothes, in the air, in our homes and offices. They can be very pleasant. They remind us of fresh mountain air or a new car, but they can also create some serious health problems. Stick around. This segment will open your eyes to what you're breathing through your nose. For the last word on today's program, I'm going to talk about the danger of cynicism, negativity, and ridicule, and why it's important for us to focus on the positive. We'll begin, though, by talking about a series of dangerous events, deadly events, that are pitting Muslims against Christians in what is shaping up to be a clash of civilizations. We'll learn about it in this report from Richard Palmer.
When you saw the flames roaring from the roof of Notre Dame Cathedral last week, did you think, I wonder if this could be an Islamist terrorist attack? I did. After all, the Islamic State has pledged to attack Christian targets. Churches in France are under attack. Terrorists have already been caught trying to attack Notre Dame Cathedral. So it seemed like a reasonable guess until we found out more information. But according to the Washington Post, I am racist for having thought that way. And this is a narrative coming increasingly out into the open. Anyone who believes there may be any kind of clash of civilizations between Islam and the West is self-evidently racist. Now, sadly, just a few days later, those of us who believed that some Muslims might attack churches were proven right.
Breaking news tonight, Easter Sunday massacre. Americans are among the more than 200 killed as bombers target churches and other sites in Sri Lanka on one of the holiest days for Christians. Did the government know?
But then, once again, the media's bias was on full display. I came across this very strongly writing an article on the Easter Sunday attack shortly after it happened. And you know, when you see these headlines about a massive attack, about hundreds dead, you have one burning question as a reader in your mind. Who did this? Who is responsible? Who just murdered all these people? You know, basic journalism dictates that that crucial fact should be one of the first things that you tell your readers. And fine, if we don't have all the information, at least as much information as we do know. Right up there, because that's the biggest question that they're asking. Yet that fact was missing from article after article. And at this point, you know, when I was writing on this on Sunday, it wasn't that we didn't know yet. The Associated Press quickly had published some strong circumstantial evidence that the Islamist group National Tawhid Jamaatha was behind the attack. On Twitter, terrorism experts, you can look and see how, just even on that Sunday, they were already beginning to connect the dots to the Islamic State. But all of that was either missing from a whole load of articles published at that time, or buried towards the bottom, rather than being, again, that burning question that people had. Now, I'm sure you've noticed this already. It's something we see all the time. If a neo-Nazi launches an attack, the headline is, "White supremacist murders dozens." If it's a Muslim, the headline is, "Hotel explosion kills 50," as if the dead are victims of some sort of spontaneous combustion. But it is getting worse. Canadian columnist Mark Stein, he wrote yesterday, in one sense, is that a line was crossed. A line was crossed in the coverage over Sri Lanka. It's becoming clearer and clearer. And there's a deliberate agenda behind this. And it's hiding one of the most important news events that we need to be watching. Talia Levin's piece last week in the Washington Post really exposed the thinking of many in the West. She wrote that article I alluded to at the beginning that just condemned anyone who, well, even just talked about Western civilization in the context of Notre Dame as basically being far-right and racist. She condemned far-right pundit Ben Shapiro for calling Notre Dame a monument to Western civilization and Judeo-Christian heritage. I don't know where she got far-right from, but then Levin is a former fact-checker who got fired for making stuff up, so accuracy is not really her strong suit. But she wrote about Ben Shapiro's comments that given that the already raging rumors are about potential Muslim involvement, these tweets evoked the specter of a war between Islam and the West that is already part of numerous far-right narratives. So just by saying something that is completely true and just even blindingly obvious, that Notre Dame is a monument to Western civilization, well, you say that's evokes a specter, and so you're far right. She concludes her article by saying, it is past time that those who stoke inflammatory rhetoric, knowing its potential to catalyze racist violence, were made to stop playing with fire. You know, if you think there's a clash of civilizations, not only are you wrong and racist, but you must be made to shut up. In the wake of the Sri Lanka attacks, the Washington Post was at it again. Yesterday, they published their view of the article. It wasn't even on the opinion pages. This was marketed as news analysis. It was titled, Christianity Under Attack? Well, they're not sure about that part. But the next part of the headline, they are sure about. No question mark there. Sri Lanka church bombings stoke far-right anger in the West. And this article states that after the Sri Lankan officials blamed a local Muslim militant group, National Tauhid Jamaatha, for the attack on Monday, European far-right groups and activists began to describe the attack in specifically religious terms. So there's a religious terrorist group attacks religious buildings on a religious holiday. But if you talk about that in religious terms, well, then you're far right. And the whole article continued in this vein, insinuating that anyone who sees some kind of clash of civilizations here is racist. This really is a dangerous cover-up by a whole host of different parts of the media, where story after story along the lines of this clash of civilizations, anything that could support that, I guess, narrative, they'd call it, is downplayed. You know, this is why you don't hear more about Christian churches being attacked in Europe. This is why you don't hear more about Christians under persecution all around the world. You know, that's a massive underreported story, where the number of Christian victims of these different persecutions are going up and up every year, but you don't hear as much about it. The fact is, the Bible prophesies that there is a clash of civilizations coming. Daniel chapter 11, towards the end, gives end-time prophecy about two power blocks, two civilizations, at least large parts of them, the king of the north and the king of the south. And these two powers clash in the Middle East, and they clash over Jerusalem, this center for religion and for faith, for Islam, for Christianity, for Judaism. There's a clear prophecy there of a clash of civilizations. You put this side by side with other prophecies and the picture becomes even clearer. Jesus Christ himself in Matthew 24 says that we need to be watching world events, because prophecies like these give us an outline of what will happen on the road to the return of Jesus Christ. By covering up, by hiding these events, by not wanting to talk about a clash of civilizations, well, these journalists are making it harder to watch the world events that Jesus Christ told us to watch for. And that's why this cover-up, this accusation that a clash of civilizations or anything that supports that is racist, that's why this idea is so dangerous.
Thank you for that, Richard. You know, it is, it's interesting. You were talking in the first part of your report there, putting it in terms of the people who are criticizing those who essentially notice reality, that this is a conflict between two religions, essentially. And they're essentially trying to silence those who notice that by accusing them of racism. But in a sense, it seems that's a view of what's happening here that they're not going to be able to ignore for very much longer.
No, I mean, you saw that even just with they had all just last week having these articles. How dare you suggest that Muslims might attack churches? And then just that very Sunday, Muslims attacking churches. I mean, it's so fundamentally at odds with reality.
Yeah,
that you kind of wonder. I mean, I wonder, in a way, that's why they have to reach for the racist card, because that, you don't have to have actual facts. You can be right and still be racist.
Yes.
And so you don't have to prove someone wrong to call them a racist. And so maybe that's why that's the easiest way of trying to criticize it. But yeah, it's so at odds with the facts already. And just you can really see, as we see more of these attacks, that position becoming more and less defensible.
So in your trumpet brief yesterday, you quoted this book by Samuel Huntington from 1996 about a clash of civilizations. And in some ways, it's refreshing to look at Huntington's view kind of before this became such a hot-button topic among the politically correct police. He's writing about it in quite frank and clear terms. Maybe you could just summarize what he was saying.
Yeah, so you see another example of exactly what we're talking about, where Huntington wrote this book in 1996 that proves tremendously prescient. That at the end of the Cold War, there were a lot of people, especially for example, Samuel Huntington's pupil, Francis Fukuyama, who were saying, or he published his book, The End of History and the Last Man, and they were saying, basically, we're heading for a one civilization. We're heading for a world where everyone kind of embraces the same principles, that will have free speech and democracy and free trade and freedom of religion and the rule of law. This is where the whole world is heading. Hmm. And Samuel Huntington, pretty quickly after the Cold War, came out and said, no, that's not what's going to happen. And he said, you'll see a world that splits into factions and you'll see them emphasize the things that divide them into these different factions. And at the biggest level, these factions are going to be civilizations, and they'll emphasize the things that divide them and the things that resonate most powerfully, and that's going to be religion. And so he has a whole chapter full of statistics on the uptick of religion, and he says, look, you're going to see religious conflict increase. He even mentions right on the first one of the pretty much page two of his book, once he talks about how you're going to see religious icons and symbolisms take on more importance. And what have we seen since then? Mm-hmm. This was written well before 9/11, well before the global war on terror, well before things like headscarves became a major issue in European politics, because yeah, it's happening exactly the way that he forecast. Yet despite the fact that he is so obviously right and had really the best kind of all the thinkers in international relations, the best really analysis of this is what the post-Cold War world will look like, despite that, he, just like these other people, was maligned as racist. Edward Said, who is kind of a populist left-wing professor, he called Samuel Huntington's ideas the purest invidious racism, a sort of parody of Hitlerian science directed today against Arabs and Muslims. So again, facts, but just dismiss it with accusation of racism.
Yeah. Well, another point that you brought out, not in the trumpet brief quite as much, but yesterday you talked about on Monday on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, you were talking about the attacks in Sri Lanka And in the context of Daniel 11, you brought out the details in that prophecy that show this is a religious clash. Tell us about that.
Right. So, as we talked about just very, very briefly in the report there, Daniel 11, it talks about these two powers, the king of the north and the king of the south. And the king of the north is referring to a power north of the Middle East. And you can start to put that with other prophecies and see that's referring to this European power. The king of the south is radical Islam led by Iran. And that scripture tells us that Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia, they're all aligned with Iran in this king of the south. So what can unite these powers? What can spread beyond borders and unite different members of a civilization? And the most powerful force that's available there is Islam and radical Islam. Now, Ethiopia is a little different. It's a Christian country, though it still has majority Muslims surrounded by Muslim countries. So you can see kind of some indication even there of a role for Islam. But then most significantly, this passage in Daniel 11, so much of it revolves around Israel and Jerusalem. And why would that be? There's some strategic significance to that territory, but there's a whole lot of strategic territory in the Middle East. Where Jerusalem stands out is its religious significance. Mm-hmm. Why would you have a clash over Jerusalem? Well, the big reason is religion. And Daniel 11 and verse 41 says that this king of the north enters the glorious land. Verse 45 talks about this king even, or at least the religious leader of the king of the north, setting up a throne in Jerusalem. He moves the seat of his religion to Jerusalem. And in his book, The King of the South, Mr. Flurry talks about it. He says, well, why would you do that? He could go to many other cities that would be safer. But he writes, but this will be a religious act of faith. So even just in Daniel 11 itself, you see this clash of civilization, this clash of two blocks, and it's a clash of religions alongside that. You start putting that alongside a lot of these other Bible prophecies, things like Revelation chapter 17 that talk about this power in Europe that is led by a woman, which is a religion in Bible prophecy. And you get this really clear picture of a religious clash building in the Middle East.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the clashes taking place between Muslims and Christians. He wrote about this in his trumpet brief yesterday. If you don't subscribe to this free email service, I'd encourage you to do so. Just go to thetrumpet.com and sign up. And you can read that online there at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for the report, Richard.
Yeah, nice to chat.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Arctic is an inhospitable region with a tremendous wealth of oil and gas reserves, gold, platinum, and other minerals. Russia is taking significant steps to dominate the region, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
Earlier this month, I had the opportunity to visit St. Petersburg, Russia by boat, which is how Peter the Great designed the city to be approached and entered into. But since the winter ice on the Baltic Sea had not all thawed, this maritime approach would have been difficult and dangerous had it not been for Russia's famous icebreaker ships. A few weeks before we came through, Russia's powerful ships had come through and blazed a trail by busting up the ice. Through the window of our cabin on the MS Princess Anastasia, we saw miles and miles of ice that had been shattered by those famous Russian vessels to make way for commerce and tourism in the waters around the nation's former capital city. In the Baltic Sea, Russia's icebreakers are an important economic asset. But there's another region where Russia's expanding fleet of icebreakers is making a more significant difference, not only economically, but also militarily, the Arctic. Historically, The frigid Arctic has been relatively free of the kinds of geopolitical struggles among major world powers that have beset most of the other regions on the globe. But in recent decades, due to thawing ice and improving technology, that has begun to change. The Arctic has become increasingly important to the nations that border it, which are the United States, Canada, Denmark, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. And none of these countries has been more determined to dominate the Arctic than Russia. And Russia's accomplishing its objectives there, largely with icebreakers. It isn't hard to see why Russia thinks that trying to control the Arctic is worth the effort. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that this area is home to about 30% of the world's undiscovered natural gas and 13% of oil. It also contains vast caches of minerals such as gold, zinc, palladium, uranium, platinum, and various rare earth metals. Some estimates say that altogether these hydrocarbons and other resources are worth as much as $30 trillion. And thanks largely to icebreakers, the Russians are tapping into this wealth at unprecedented rates. One area where we can see this is at the Yamal liquid natural gas plant, which is located almost 380 miles north of the Arctic Circle line. In the local language, Yamal literally means end of the world. And it's easy to see why this is an appropriate name. Temperatures around the peninsula drop as low as 58 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. And for 2 months of the year, there's zero sunlight there. And for 7 to 9 months of every year, the waters around this wasteland are frozen solid, in ice up to 7 feet thick. Until mining facilities are opened up on the moon, or maybe Mars, or maybe deep in the Mariana Trench, you will not find a more hostile environment for industry than the one surrounding the Yamal liquid natural gas plant. But thanks to a new fleet of 15 icebreakers that can bust through the ice and carry liquefied natural gas shipments, the Russians can keep operations at the plants humming year-round as they extract and transport Yamal's 44 trillion cubic feet of natural gas reserves. Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Yamal's facilities in 2017, and he made clear that the plant there and its icebreakers are part of a much larger vision to dominate the region. He said, quote, "This is perhaps the largest step forward in our developing of the Arctic. Now we can safely say that Russia will expand through the Arctic this and next century," end quote. One major part of Putin's expansion into the Arctic is his work on developing the Northern Sea Route. This is a route that runs along Russia's Arctic coast, starting in the Kara Sea and going east all the way to the Bering Sea and then out into the Pacific Ocean. Without this route, if Russia wants to ship gas and oil from Yamal and other Arctic locations to China, for example, they have to spend about 40 to 45 days sailing west around Norway and then past the UK and Spain and then east heading into the Mediterranean Sea, then through the Suez and around India and finally to China. But with this Northern Sea route, Russia can send it right along its Arctic coast and then straight down to China. It cuts shipments by as much as 25 days. So this is an incredibly valuable shipping lane if they can keep it open during the frozen winters. And with icebreakers, the Russians are able to do that better and better. And Russia is also now tightening its grip on this Northern Sea route in a troubling way. Moscow announced in March that foreign ships sailing through it have to submit a request 45 days in advance. They have to bring a Russian maritime pilot aboard for the crossing, and they have to pay hefty additional transit fees. Moscow said that any vessel that fails to comply can be detained and even eliminated. And even if a foreign vessel does abide by all of these requirements, authorities say Russia can reject any request for passage with no explanation. The illegal part of these new Russian rules concerns the Bering Strait, which is there between Russia and the U.S. state of Alaska. If we look at the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, it says that waters 200 nautical miles from a given nation's coast constitute that country's exclusive economic zone. And it says that the nation is granted control over them. But international straits, such as the Bering Strait, are specifically excluded from the exclusive economic zones. And the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea guarantees freedom of navigation through them. Contrary to these international laws, Russia insists that the Northern Sea Route, including the Bering Strait, is subject to its new rules. This is an illegal policy, but because of an ever-widening icebreaker gap between Russia and the rest of the world, Russia's grip on the Arctic will only get tighter. Terrell Starr wrote about this massive icebreaker gap in a recent article for Foxtrot Alpha. And he wrote, quote, "You can't explore the depths of the Arctic or traverse its seas if you can't get to it. Russia's icebreakers make it king of the Arctic, and America is just a pauper." If you look at the numbers here, you see that Terrell Starr is exactly right. With 46 icebreakers, including six that are nuclear-powered, Russia already has the world's largest fleet of icebreakers by far. A distant second place with 10 ships goes to Finland, and then Canada and Sweden are tied for third place with 7 each. The United States, meanwhile, has 5 icebreakers, none of which are nuclear. The number of icebreakers alone doesn't tell the whole story. The size and power also matter. Only Russia and the U.S. operate heavy icebreakers, which have the power to break through thicker ice packs. But here again, Russia has a major advantage with 2 operational heavy icebreakers and 4 more that are currently in refit. The United States, meanwhile, has just 1, which is the 42-year-old U.S. CGC Polar Star. And the Polar Star also operates in Antarctica, on the other side of the globe. So not only are Russia's heavy icebreakers considerably younger than the Polar Star, but they also remain in the Arctic year-round. And Putin says that by 2035, Russia will have 13 heavy icebreakers, including 9 nuclear-powered behemoths. So the icebreaker gap will just keep on getting wider. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan recently said, "The highways of the Arctic are icebreakers. Russia has superhighways, and we have dirt roads with potholes." As Russia's fleets keep growing, the United States and other nations will find it ever more difficult to challenge Putin's control of the region. And this is about a lot more than just mining for energy and establishing shipping routes. In the last few years, Russia has also rushed to revive many abandoned Soviet military bases in the Arctic. Thanks largely to its icebreakers, the Russians have revamped airstrips and radar facilities on numerous islands. They've established 4 new Arctic Brigade command units. They've opened 16 ports, built new air bases, and have deployed anti-ship missiles and ground-to-air missile systems to the region. Mikhail Barabanov, editor-in-chief of Moscow Defense Brief, recently spoke to Reuters about these developments, and he said, quote, "The modernization of Arctic forces and of Arctic military infrastructure is taking place at an unprecedented pace not seen even in Soviet times." End quote. With all of these bases and missiles, Russia can guard its energy claims in the region, and it can enforce its new rules for the Northern Sea Route, whether or not the other Arctic nations agree with the legality of them. If we look at the fairly recent history of Russia here, we see that after the collapse of the Soviet Union back in 1991, Russia trudged through a decade or more as a very depleted and exhausted nation. It was on the outside of the mainstream of international affairs, and many Westerners basically ignored Russia during this time. But then Putin came into power, and he began to right the ship and change its course. In August of 2008, he shocked much of the world by invading the former Soviet nation of Georgia and bringing 1/5 of Georgia's internationally recognized territory under Russia's control. That October, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote about what the invasion signaled for the future. He wrote, quote, "Russia's attack on Georgia in August marks the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. This was the first military strike of a rising Asian superpower, and there will be more. We have witnessed the beginning of a new era." Mr. Fleury went on to say that Russia would strike Ukraine next, and time proved that forecast accurate, with Russia's 2014 invasion and annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Since then, Putin has continued using his power to prevent Georgia, Ukraine, and other former Soviet countries from developing closer ties with Europe. He also persuaded Kyrgyzstan to evict the U.S. from the Manas airbase. He's made Russia a major player in the Middle East, and he's transformed Russia's military into a modern, more lethal 21st century force, including his intensification of efforts to militarize and control the Arctic. It's clear that Putin is restoring Russia's power and boosting its international relevance back to Soviet levels. And it's clear that, as Mr. Fleury wrote, the world is now in a dangerous new era. Bible prophecy shows that in the months and years ahead, Putin will lead Russia into an even more dangerous and aggressive direction. In his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Mr. Fleury explains that Putin is personally described in ancient Bible prophecies in Ezekiel 38 and 39, and he writes, "We need to watch Vladimir Putin closely. I believe he is almost certain to be the Prince of Russia whom God inspired Ezekiel to write about 2,500 years ago." Vladimir Putin's rule indicates that we are entering into a time of extreme crisis, but Mr. Fleury writes that these developments are, quote, super inspiring at the same time. He writes, "Vladimir Putin is a sign, literally a sign that Jesus Christ is about to return. It's just a few short years away." The rise of Putin's Russia, including its dominance of the Arctic, shows that nuclear World War III is near. And this is something that should sober every one of us. But these trends are also intimately tied to the best imaginable news. Jesus Christ will soon return to earth and bring in an age of unprecedented peace and prosperity for the whole world.
We've been listening to trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Russia's battle for dominance over the Arctic. He has an article up at thetrumpet.com about this. It's titled "Russian Icebreakers and the War for the Arctic." Go check it out. You can also find Gerald Fleury's booklet, "The Prophesied Prince of Russia," under the literature tab at thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Let's talk about smells. Our sense of smell is probably the most underrated of our senses. Recent studies show humans can detect at least 1 trillion distinct scents, even when they're diluted to less than 1 part per several billion parts of air. Scents can evoke powerful memories and strong emotions. And manufacturers tap into that powerful emotional response in consumers. That's why artificial scents are in everything from shampoos, perfumes, air fresheners, house cleaners, candles, dryer sheets. These chemical molecules not only smell good, but they have brought about some serious health concerns. To talk about this, we have from his office in British Columbia, a man who often speaks to us about health-related questions, nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian. Hello, Jörg.
Good day.
So, what's the difference between a fragrance and a smell?
Right. So, a smell is something that alerts us to things in life, like, say, a danger or a gas leak, fire, rotten food, and these smells are linked to the brain processes that create emotion and memory, as you were stating in the opening. So it's very important that we have that sense of smell. Now, in a commercial industry, they have what's called commercial fragrances. And that's anything that sends, adds a smell to something. So like a household item that we would need or desire. And usually they try to make that smell something that we really like, a scent that evokes that emotion or that desire in a consumer.
Right.
So you've heard them say, well, our product smells like mountain air.
Yeah.
Well, mountain air really doesn't smell like a lot. or falling rain or fresh Irish spring. Those are just made up scents. You know, commercialism is really good, the wording on it. So we tend to think, yes, this really does smell like mountain air. But, you know, it, in a real sense, if you go on top of a mountain, it just smells fresh. There's nothing that you can really relate it to. And you can't really bottle that. So they have to make something that they believe evokes that memory of a mountain, that triggers a memory or evokes a mood. So in essence, they're tricking us into accepting an artificial smell as the real deal.
That's very interesting. You know, I'm sure that there are plenty of people who have given this thought, but this is something that just hasn't really entered my mind. You kind of have, you take it for granted that if you get a product that it smells like, you know, cedar or mountain air, some kind of mint or whatever it might be, that in a lot of cases, those fragrances are not necessarily, it's basically something that someone somewhere in a lab had to manufacture. They're combining chemicals in a way that evokes something in us, but it's a very artificial process, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. And I'm glad you mentioned cedar, because I was surprised that a store might even have an artificial cedar scent. And they might not even carry the cedar products. But they understand that people come in and they want them to get the shopping experience. So a grocery store without having a bakery might pump in the aroma of chocolate or baked bread. A car dealership will, you know, that new car smell. Yes. That's just sprayed under the seat and that'll last a few months. Or a hotel will create what's called a scent logo. It's their distinct fragrance, and it just creates a more pleasant environment and reinforces a brand. It's very, very powerful. Nike actually ran a study, and they showed that adding a scent to their stores works radically well. I mean, it increased intent to purchase by 80%.
That's amazing. What in the world? So there's a lot more of this going on than we're even aware of. So, but the fact that these are chemicals, let's talk about what the side effects might be beyond just the fact that it might cause us to empty our wallets more quickly.
Right. So as we were stating, the nose is powerful. We rely on it for so many things, but with the increased popularity of these scented products, there's also a lot of anecdotal and clinical evidence of these scents triggering and just exacerbating many, many health conditions. And many of them are hidden, too, where the doctor has no idea where it's coming from. And it's not really something that's really out there in the literature to the point where doctors are acting on it. So the reason is this. If you take, say, your shampoo, you turn it around and you read the back of the ingredients. And this was a real eye-opener to me, because I always thought, you know what, I'm kind of aware that there's chemicals in here and I should watch it, but I was never aware of just how bad it was. So when you see the word fragrance on the back, which you will, that's a blend of between 100 to 350 ingredients under the singular title fragrance. And even worse, there's about 5,000 fragrance ingredients that are used in heavy rotation between these products. But under U.S. law, these manufacturers are given a free pass from revealing exactly which fragrances are in these products.
Well, they wouldn't have enough space on the back of the product to list them if there are 350 of them.
Well, imagine how it would look, though, if you just started listing all these chemicals. Now, you know, even more comprehensible, the industry regulates itself under what's called the International Fragrance Association. So basically they say, yes, we've said that this is correct, but we don't have to show you. It doesn't cause any health conditions, and we won't talk about how many are in here or what it does at all. So the law really gives them free rein, and then as expected, studies show that in many products there's at least one carcinogen.
Wow.
And there's what's called allergens and respiratory irritants and endocrine disruptors, neurotoxic chemicals. I mean, they dominate the ingredient list, and it's known. We've tested, scientists have tested this, and they know about it. And what happens is these chemical molecular substances, you put them on your head, you spray them on you as a perfume, you inhale them through fragrances, and they're absorbed into the body. And the general population, there's about 30% of individuals in the United States, roughly around 95 million people, that show serious health concerns because of fragrances.
Wow. So, you mentioned several of those chemicals and the kind of, you mentioned carcinogens and other like direct links to specific health conditions. What sort of symptoms would be common in people who are having these kinds of, that kind of sensitivity?
Well, I mean, you have a lot of people with respiratory problems. You have immune conditions. We really don't understand the full extent of what these type of solvents that go into the nose. And by the way, when we inhale these things, by the time you smell them, they've already gone past your brain and they've settled. That's how fast it gets. It just dives underneath the brain. And our sense of smell is so quick that by the time you smell it, it's already in the body. And so you start getting everything from irritation, skin conditions, respiratory, all the way up to cancer and, say, fibromyalgia. And, you know, these, we can't really explain a type of conditions, and we're guessing at what it is. There's many, many of those. And you'd be surprised at the products that really caused this.
Well, let's talk about that. What would you consider, say, the prime offenders? You mentioned shampoos and perfumes.
Right. So big ones would be the ones that you really get a powerful smell from, like, say, fabric softeners and dryer sheets. I mean, they've been connected to pancreatic cancer. So you've got lung irritations, you've got respiratory distress, you've even got heart attacks coming from this stuff.
From dryer sheets?
Yes, because those scents are specifically meant to cling to your clothing. That's why they smell fresh. And so you will breathe these in all day long. So not only they can either touch your skin and get absorbed very, very quickly, you know, in under 20 seconds, or they can be breathed in. So these chemicals are never far from the body. Laundry detergent is another one. You know, it has what they say reproductive and developmental effects. It's really hard on fetuses, and even formaldehyde has been found added to the formulas, believe it or not, formaldehyde, the preservative for bodies. And so you've got all these chemicals that are hormone disruptions, cancer, birth defects, fertility. And, you know, I get so many clients in here saying my hormones are all messed up, and we really don't have a starting point anymore for these things, whether it's food or chemicals or whatever. We, you know, we have to guess, what are you using? Well, I'm using shampoos and moisturizers. I'm using a lot of perfumes. big one, very big one, is air fresheners. I mean, these things have nothing to do with health. They're, you know, especially odor neutralizers. They are, they have carcinogens in them. And what they do is they work by attacking the receptors in your nose. And it's really a chemical attack on the nose, and it eliminates, it kills your sense of smell. And that's not supposed to happen. You know, and there's nothing about the process that you can call healthy. I mean, killing your sense of smell, which you were born with. So researchers, there was a study at the University of Washington in West Georgia, and they found that nearly one in five directly linked to these fragrances suffer from headaches, breathing difficulties, depression, irregular heartbeats, just all kinds of health challenges when it, when they're directly exposed to air fresheners, or they have scent discs, they have plug-ins, they have gels. You know, there's there's all kinds in the supermarket, and people are snapping them up, saying, you know, thinking they're doing something good for their air.
Yeah. Well, let's oh, go ahead and say about candles.
Yeah, candles are the last one I wanted to talk about, because I was really surprised, because they have, some candles have these shiny wicks in the middle, these metal wicks. And what they actually do is release lead particles. And these float through the air and you don't really see them. And they settle on your furniture, and they settle, and you breathe them in. And so kids touch them because they're playing on the couch. You've got little kids running around. And these are found to have been found in the human brain, and they're associated with Alzheimer's.
Wow. Well, we're just about out of time, but if you wouldn't mind giving us some thoughts on how to eliminate these from our lives.
Well, I've got two websites that would give more information than I could give at the moment. And one of them is, it gives a list of toxic cleaning products that you can look up. And it's called lesstoxicguide.ca. And it's very in-depth. So you can buy all the products that you need, or look at how to eliminate, looking at the lists and which ingredients you need to look at. And the second one is a Skin Deep database. That's what it's called, a Skin Deep database. And it assesses and compares the safety of a lot of those shampoos and the skin creams and the baby products, especially, which are shown to have the same chemicals that humans are, that adults are exposed to.
Fascinating topic. I really appreciate you bringing that to us. We've been talking with nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian about the dangers in the fragrances that we are breathing in and touching every day without even realizing it. He's working on an article on this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Jörg.
It's been my pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
We have become a nation of ridicule. Our leaders insult each other like school children. Our journalists compete to craft the most contemptuous criticisms. Our commentators, celebrities, and comedians multiply the cynicism, arrogance, and condescension. Online and in person, our public and private discourse is cynical, rancorous, condescending, flippant, vulgar, negative, and mean. Whether in the halls of power, the television studio, or the living room couch, people are sitting on thrones of judgment, firing off mockery at will. Now, you might not think of yourself as a scornful person, but unless you're actively fighting this spirit of the age, it's rubbing off on you. Does Proverbs 30, verses 11 through 14 sound familiar? It says, there's a generation that curses their father and does not bless their mother. There's a generation that are pure in their own eyes and yet is not washed from their filthiness. There's a generation, oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up. There's a generation whose teeth are as swords, and their jaw teeth as knives to devour the poor from off the earth and the needy from among men. We see a lot of this going on in the world today. People who are haughty and arrogant, who lack compassion and tenderness, who say evil and violent things, morally filthy people who consider themselves clean. And they're full of contempt for people they consider unworthy or inferior. Sitting back in judgment is easy. It's gratifying. When someone makes what you think is a mistake, all you have to do is criticize, and suddenly you feel you're better than him. And this selfish payoff comes even if he has far more knowledge, experience, skill, character than you, even if he's one of the best in his field, even if he's attempting something far more daring than you've ever attempted. But if you can think of some biting ridicule, you can make yourself seem better than him. Not even the praiseworthy, the good, or the beautiful can escape this spiteful spirit. It's easy, it's fun, it's potent, and it's addictive. But where does this spirit come from? God is the most positive being in the universe. He's full of kindness, mercy, and compassion toward every human being. God is love, which means he's very patient and kind. He's never rude, never selfish, never irritated, never resentful. God is never glad when others go wrong. He's always gladdened by goodness. He's always slow to expose wrong, always eager to believe the best, and always hopeful. You might recognize that language from 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 8. Satan, the devil, by contrast, is the most negative being in the universe. He's bitter, cynical, resentful, eager to expose wrong and emphasize mistakes. He believes the worst, and he hopes for people to fail. He inspires this ugly and dangerous spirit of ridicule in people, and it can manifest itself in any of us. Did you know God hates this negative, judgmental, arrogant self-righteousness? Proverbs 6, verses 16 to 17 lists seven things God hates, and at the top of that list is a proud look. Do you have a proud look that views and judges everything around you through a filter of arrogance? And what concludes that list of things God hates? A person who stirs up conflict and strife in a family or in a community. The tendency to make fun of everything and everyone definitely divides people. It splits families apart. It's turning our modern nations into entrenched camps separated by desolate no man's land, unable to agree on anything. It's also dividing us from the God of love because it inflates our pride. And God resists the proud, it says in 1 Peter 5. True, there are genuinely things to criticize and condemn in the world today, and we should have a clear-eyed view of those things. But we should condemn the evil itself, not the person. And we should always beware the trap of pride and condescension. After all, evil resides in our own heart as well. The Apostle Peter instructs, "Yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility." Clothe yourself in humility, and then you'll feel less tempted to find something to ridicule and half whisper your snide put downs. Instead, you'll discover respect for others. You'll recognize virtue when you see it. You'll find things to praise. You'll be thinking more like God. Now, God has a sense of humor, and there are good-natured ways to tease someone that can actually draw you closer to that person. The spirit of that type of humor is totally different from the spirit of ridicule, sarcasm, and mockery. When you feel tempted to mock, stop. Remember where those thoughts come from. Instead, focus on what is good and praise that. Be inspired by God's attitude in Philippians 4 and verses 8 through 9. Whatsoever things are true, Whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Jörg Mardian. I'll leave you with this thought from William E. Gladstone. Men are apt to mistake the strength of their feeling for the strength of their argument. The heated mind resents the chill touch and relentless scrutiny of logic. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.